Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Versus History. My name is Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me is Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon, Elliot, and good afternoon, listeners. It is great to be here yet again.
Yes, it is indeed. Now, just a quick word on our previous podcast, which was a debate about the reputation of Field Marshal Haig. It went very well, and the response has been fantastic. Overwhelming, I might say. Over 1,000 downloads, and still going strong. So thank you very much to all of our listeners. Please continue to subscribe. Any comments or suggestions that you have, please fire them over to us. Now, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
What are we going to talk about today?
It's another head-to-head debate.
It is indeed.
Versus history. Which side was responsible for the start of the Cold War? That's it, isn't it?
That is it. Now, I shall be arguing one side, as ever, and Patrick will be arguing against us.
Robert Service's new book, The End of the Cold War, 85 to 91, starts with this very, very succinct overview of the Cold War. The Cold War was the state of neither war nor peace between America and the USSR in the decades after the Second World War. Victory in 45 over Germany and Japan had left them as the two global superpowers, and their own subsequent standoff could at any time have erupted into a hot war with nuclear weapons that no one anywhere on Earth would survive. On both sides, politicians and public alike quickly recognised the dangers of the situation. But although everyone wanted to prevent a Third World War, the US-Soviet struggle seemed interminable as ever, and more destructive atomic arsenals were built up. Should we stop there?
Yeah, let's leave it there. If you're going to get a definition or an overview, why not get it from this man?
Exactly. Would you like to open up, Elliot, and make your opening statement?
Okay. Well, it's not so much an opening statement, but this is where I stand. My version of the causes of the Cold War, the perspective from which I'll be viewing it, is from the Soviet perspective, in as much as I shall be blaming the Americans for starting the Cold War. Tension that was heightened at various times throughout, essentially 1945 to 1991, although I'm sure Patrick's going to go back a little further than that, was brought about primarily by the offensive actions of the United States, and that any cause or any responsibility for directly initiating the Cold War must fall on the shoulders of the United States, because whatever the Soviet Union did, and whether we liked the communist regime that ruled over Russia for such a long period of time, whatever we think of that, the fact of the matter is, in foreign policy at least, Russia were not to blame. Their actions were primarily defensive and a reaction literally to the offensive foreign policy of the United States. So, where should we go from here?
I'm going to be arguing the complete opposite, that it was actually the primary catalyst for the start of Cold War was the Soviet Union and its actions.
So you're arguing that from October 1917, so you're going way back before World War II, and you're suggesting that the origin of the Soviet state was actually the origin of the Cold War.
Yes, that's essentially what I'll be arguing. In terms of the disciplinary standpoint, I think it's always good to go back and look at the long-term causes. And in this instance, I think the long-term causes, that being the Russian Revolution of October 1917, was the actual start date of the very quiet and mooted Cold War initially, which really then does flare up after the end of the Second World War. So that's going to be my standpoint.
Right. Well, I'm going to jump in right here, and I'm going to say that I think that perhaps you are conflating the origins of the Soviet state with the causes of the Cold War. Inasmuch as, let's say, Hitler came from Austria, that his origin was Austrian, you wouldn't necessarily blame Austria as a cause of Hitler, or rather you wouldn't say that Austria was a cause of Hitler. So in that respect, I would say that going that far back to 1917 as a direct cause of the Cold War is perhaps a little unhelpful here, unless, of course, you can prove to me otherwise.
I will do my very, very best. Would you like me to
Absolutely.
Have a go? Okay, let's lay the context then. We have World War One. We have Russia, France and Britain versus the Central Powers. Now, it may interest our listeners to learn that Russia left World War One prior to the 11th of the 11th, 1918. They actually signed a separate peace treaty with Germany prior to its conclusion, called the Brest-Litovsk Treaty.
That's correct, yes.
Excellent. Okay, so Russia left the war early, largely because there was a revolution in Russia, the Communist Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution of October 1917. Now, it may further interest our listeners to hear that Lenin's arrival in Russia during World War I was actually an aggressive action by the Germans, their enemies. Now, we may well be thinking, why on earth would the Germans aid and abet Lenin, a Russian, during war? Well, really and truly, this was part of the Germans' war strategy. They were not averse in any way, shape or form to foreign meddling. For instance, they aimed to help the Irish nationalists prior to the East Uprising with the supply of a cachet of arms. They also tried to inculcate a Mexican invasion of America. And finally, and probably most significantly, they wanted Russia to undertake or undergo a revolution of the communist variety, not because of any German affinity to communism, far from it, solely so that Lenin could lead Russia out of the war, therefore freeing up German troops from the Eastern Front to go to the Western. So this was actually an offensive action. And do you want me to continue at this point?
I'm still struggling to see the link between the Germans essentially putting Lenin on the throne and it causing the Cold War.
No, see, this is going a long, long way back. The next point isn't the revolution per se. It's more the ideology of communism, which is all about exporting revolution. Foreign intervention, and this is a quote from historian Dominic Levine in his most recent book, Towards the Flame. Foreign intervention was a key factor in the Bolshevik success. Obviously during the revolution. Lenin only returned to Russia in 1917 with German help, that which we know. Now, this is where it gets interesting. The Russian Revolution undermined the war effort for the Western powers and led the way to a separate peace on the Eastern Front. Now, this is where it gets even more important. This is talking about exporting revolution. Lenin never lost sight of the revolution's international scale. As the first socialist society, Soviet Russia had a mission and a responsibility to emancipate humanity by spreading revolution throughout the world. Now, this was a leitmotif of Soviet foreign policy. They were all about and preoccupied with, especially during Lenin's reign, the exporting of communist revolution anywhere and everywhere in the world, which is obviously going to be seen and interpreted as an offensive action on behalf of the Soviet Union towards their fellow global citizens. So that is why I've gone back so far. And you'll have to forgive me for doing that.
I'm glad that you did, because in a sense, because I'm going to challenge what you've just said there about the exporting of communism abroad, because I think we all know that whilst Lenin and Trotsky were interested in spreading communism abroad, they believed that communism perhaps would stagnate and die and they wanted a global revolution, by the end of 1924, Lenin is dead. Stalin is essentially becomes the de facto ruler and the official ruler in 1928. Trotsky's gone. And we know that Stalin had very little interest in exporting Soviet communism abroad until his focus was to have one Russia. His focus was in consolidating communism within Russia. So I don't see how the man who led the Soviet Union until 1953 and was not particularly interested in exporting communism should be compared to the very brief tenure of Lenin and the influence of Trotsky way back 1917 through to 1922, 23, 24. I don't see the comparison there.
So Stalin was a big proponent of socialism in one country, but we must bear in mind this was only a short-term strategy to achieve the longer-term goal of actually exporting revolution, which is ultimately what's going to happen post-World War II with satellite states. I quote Orlando Figes, one of my favourite historians, from day one of Soviet power, they waited with impatience for this revolutionary struggle to begin abroad, receiving every report of a strike or protest as the start. Now, Stalin, from 1928, when he does become the legitimate ruler of Russia, he does take an insular foreign policy strategy, as opposed to Trotsky, who was all about exporting revolution. However, that really does remain Stalin's end goal, his long-term gain, as will be seen with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 39. He still wants to export revolution, however, he's just focusing on the short-term goal of industrializing Russia. He's very aware that in terms of industrialization, Russia was leaps and bounds behind the West and had to industrialize very quickly. But had to industrialize very, very quickly, not for peaceful means, really just for communist aggrandizement.
Okay, can I just jump in? You're saying that socialism in one country, this desire not to export communism or socialism abroad, was a short-term aim, but ultimately that Stalin's goal was somehow world domination. Well, first of all, he's in charge essentially from 1924 onwards, whatever we say about his actual legitimate premiership from 28 onwards. So we're saying from 1924 all the way through to 1945, perhaps, but be generous and say 1939. Do you have any evidence of any expansion beyond the borders of the Soviet Union at all.
I think we have to go to 1939 and to realise the Soviets, if we want a manifest treaty, to realise the Soviets' carnivorous international intentions.
Ooh, carnivorous!
that's hopefully something our students can drop into their own essays. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was essentially a very surprising pact between Russia and Germany, where they essentially agreed to not fight each other in the short term, but there were secret clauses about Poland there. They were going to divide Poland up, basically have half each. That, I think, is reflective of the deeper and innate Soviet desire to eventually expand. The only reason I'm contending Stalin didn't expand between 28 and 39 was because they were undergoing the process, the facilitatory process, to enable them to do so in the long term. There's no way Stalin could have expanded in 1928 because Russia was essentially an economic basket case. However, by 1939, with their five-year plans, so on and so forth, collectivization, they were now ready. The platform had been laid, ladies and gentlemen, in my view, for this aggrandizement to become manifest and actually take place.
Right.
So that's where I'd like to go, but obviously you're going to counter that.
My counter is this. My entire argument is that the Cold War, or any actions that could be seen as the Soviet Union causing the Cold War, was a reaction, and that it was a defensive action. Now, you just jumped into 1939, you're talking about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and you've described that as an example of the Soviet Union's carnivorous desire to eat up Europe and the rest of the world. But I'm going to contend that one of the only reasons they signed that pact is because they knew that Germany was in such a military situation, and a position of military strength, and they realized that Germany were expanding and they were going to continue to expand, and the only way that they could safeguard their own interests was to actually sign an agreement with the Nazis at this time, thereby undermining the idea that this was offensive. This was defensive. They had been attacked by the Germans in World War One, and they didn't want it to happen again. Now, tell me what's offensive about that.
I'd like to just draw the comparison to what America was doing in the 1920s and 1930s, just to draw the comparison between that which the two actors we're debating were actually undertaking. I know you'll know this quote very, very well. I know your penchant, Dr. Watson, is America and American history. Now, America essentially became isolationist during this period, focusing exclusively on its own industrial capacity, mass production, essentially generating its economy. And one of my favourite quotes from Calvin Coolidge, "The business of America is business." That was their exclusive focus. There was no manifest, obvious, explicit, internationalist, expansionist intentions on behalf of America. Whereas we can already see from the Soviet Union, already we have internationalist, expansionist intentions. Where if we draw the comparison and juxtapose them with their fellow actor and soon to be global superpower, America, they were focusing exclusively inwardly on their own prosperity, on their own development. Whereas Stalin, you could say, with his five-year plans, was focusing on Russia's economic domestic development, but that was really for the purpose of future aggrandizement, to make manifest and to make real and to make a de facto reality expansionist policy, geographical aggrandizement. I've said a lot there, Elliot.
You have, and I'm actually going to challenge you on quite a lot of it, because first of all, the idea that the United States was isolationist is generally contended during the 1930s is generally seen as an erroneous assumption. FDR himself instituted what he called the good neighbor policy with Latin America, which was essentially a reimagining of the Monroe Doctrine, just in slightly friendlier terms. And the idea that they were isolationist in any other foreign policy is undermined by the Cash and Carry Act in 1939, Lend-Lease in 1941, and so on, all of which were designed specifically to, as you to use your word, aggrandize their own business interests. And it was these business interests that helped to determine the course of the Cold War. Any number of historians have investigated and proved that a great cause of American involvement abroad, or the so-called abandonment of isolationism after World War II, was driven by the desire for trade. I mean, Germany, West Germany, Japan, one of the reasons it expanded and took paternalist care and administration of Japan was because Japan was seen as one of the five industrial centers of the world. Germany was one of those five industrial centers. So I think that you've actually just helped my argument by suggesting
he loves saying this,
by
doesn't
suggesting
he?
That the Americans were only focused on business. I would say they were very much focused on business. Mm. That was one of the causes of the Cold War.
As was Soviet aggrandizement with satellite states. But shall we, because of time, shall we draw the line on the sort of the build-up?
Right,
into
let's get into it.
Shall we do
then.
That? Happy
yeah.
to do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's roll then.
Right. Well, one of the solid concrete events that is usually taken to prove that the Soviet Union was directly responsible for the Cold War was the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I definitely
okay.
would, yeah.
Well, my contention is that the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe, so countries like Czechoslovakia, Hungary, former Yugoslavia, etc., that this takeover was specifically defensive. Their goal was to produce a buffer zone against what they considered, and what most historians considered, a very, very real threat by the West, by the Allies, that once Germany was defeated, they would turn their attentions to the Soviet Union. And there is plenty of evidence to suggest that they were thinking that. So, what is your argument?
I think you've made some great points there, Elliot.
I always do, thank you very much.
And I accept that Stalin used the excuse that he was creating a buffer zone or a friendly zone. However, a perceived threat from the West isn't the same as an actual threat. Just because Stalin may think it's a threat or present it as such, that doesn't mean it actually was a threat. It could just be the excuse to do what he wanted to do anyway. Let's use the example of Poland. He wanted that for himself and was not prepared to accept any democratic latitude there. So he didn't even want friendly states. He wanted friendly states who were under the thumb. What I'm trying to say is it's saying you feel under threat isn't a legitimate excuse for precipitating an attack yourself and then subsequently making the whole of East Europe a buffer zone of satellite states without any humanitarian freedoms. If we look at the swathe of countries, I'm going to just list a few just for effect, that Stalin sort of claimed to be liberating but then outstayed his welcome as an occupier. Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Finland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, Eastern Europe became his back garden. That's obviously jolly unfortunate for history, but just because Stalin presents a potential threat or something as being a potential threat doesn't mean it was and it doesn't make it right.
Right, brilliant.
Nor does it make it defensive. It's actually offensive.
Okay, well, I'm going to go with defensive. I'm going to continue to go for it. I'm also going to draw the listener's attention to the fact that Patrick just used the word jolly in reference to the Cold War.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Okay, right. So the argument is that perceived threat is not justification or suitable justification for what Stalin did. Now, I would draw your attention to pretty much every aspect of American foreign policy going all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine. I would say that preemption is a central tenet of American foreign policy and has been for about 250 years. The Monroe Doctrine stipulated that the Americans, should they feel under threat by anything taking place in Latin American countries, they reserve the right to involve themselves. You have the Truman Doctrine, is something I hope you're going to mention, which basically states that they will assist any peoples that are to them, who so being perceived by the Americans, those who are being subjugated by outside pressures or armed minorities. I'm going to draw your attention to. You said that Russia said that they were liberating, but then they just subjugated. If you remember the Philippines, when the Americans won the Spanish-American War in 1898, they did exactly the same thing. I'm even going to draw your attention to the American invasion of Iraq, when under the Bush Doctrine, they specifically claimed in foreign policy any right to invade anywhere should they perceive a threat. So on you go, Patrick.
Well, we have a first on versus history, ladies and gentlemen. Elliot Watson has gone back further chronologically than me. I went back to 1917 and he gave me a hard time, proverbially, obviously. Dr. Watson's just gone back to the Monroe Doctrine of 1823.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Wow.
Foreign policy is foreign policy.
Savour it, ladies and gentlemen, because I doubt it will happen again. But getting back to the debate, I mean, if we're talking about the Truman Doctrine, I could utilise the same argument that which you used. It was very much laced in defensive language, protecting the freedoms of free peoples and the freedom of democracy. Essentially, it was there as a safeguard, preventing Western European democracies mainly from becoming additions to the catalogue of Soviet satellite states. So essentially, it was a defensive manoeuvre or a defensive strategy aimed at precluding further Soviet aggrandizement. So if we're going to use the defensive argument, we could quite easily counter. I think that the Truman Doctrine was also a defensive doctrine, really aimed solely and exclusively at ensuring the freedoms of fellow countries, capitalist Western democracies, providing them with a platform from which they could secure their independence and freedom from becoming another Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. How would you see that?
Well, I think that once you accepted the help of the Americans, then you were as much in debt and tied to their foreign policy goals as you possibly were under the Soviet Union. Now, that's not to say that the Soviet Union were in any way democratic in their running of these satellite states. But I think get back to the original point, which is who caused the Cold War. Mm. Ideologically, because without the existence of communism, of course, there cannot be a Cold War.
Yeah.
You have to say the origins of the Cold War ideologically are back in 1917. But I think if you look at the interpretations of what happened immediately after World War II, the offensive action were taken by the Americans. And let's not forget that Churchill himself offered much of the territory of Eastern Europe in his percentages deals to Stalin. And Churchill was obviously very closely tied to Roosevelt. So who's the bad guy here?
That's a good question, isn't it? Under the Marshall Plan, the United Kingdom got well over $3 billion worth of aid. They were given far more latitude on how they spent that. For instance, huge swathe of nationalisations, which is sort of quite a left-wing policy, really, post-war.
Yes.
Whereas those countries who received, I quote, aid or assistance or comradely support from the Soviet Union had absolutely no choice or latitude in how that money was applied or spent. So in terms of aggressive actions in the countries that they had taken over or were supporting, surely we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the Americans there. They were not aggrandizing their territory via cash. Vis-a-vis the Russians, who definitely were.
Okay, if we're talking about aggrandizing, you mentioned earlier that the Soviets left their armies in Eastern Europe, so they came as liberators, was your argument, and yet they stayed with their military.
Yep.
If we're going to go with the idea that America abandoned isolationism after World War II, you have to look at where they left their military, and I think you'll find it was in Japan. I think you'll find it was in the Middle East, in Saudi. I think you'll find it's in Britain. I think you'll find it is in Germany. I think you'll find it is in France. I think you'll find it is in many of these countries that they claimed to help. One of the stipulations of Marshall Aid and the aid and assistance was that they were allowed to leave residual military presences there.
But you've mentioned Germany, and Russia definitely left a lot of troops in Germany.
Of course, absolutely. But what is the origin? Who caused this?
Without a doubt, the Soviet Union. The Americans would eventually leave, whereas the Russians never would.
Have the Americans ever left West Germany militarily? Or is there still a large American military presence in Germany?
There certainly is, but the Russian one was only removed after the fall of the USSR. So it's a bit of a... I can see your point, but it's don't know how valid that is historically, because the Soviets stayed up until end game there. So shall we leave that one there and move on to the post-World War II? Can I contend that the first offensive action taken between the superpowers was actually during the Berlin crisis, when the Soviets blocked the road and blocked the routes into West Berlin, basically trying to starve it at birth, trying to turn West Germany into basically just to gazump it and absorb it and digest it into East Germany. If we're looking at offensive action between the superpowers, I will contend that the USSR has the honour of being the first in that regard. What would you contend to that one?
I would say that it doesn't look good for Stalin. I admit that the blockade has been interpreted, and quite rightly so, as a horrible misstep by Stalin, because ultimately it didn't work. It made him an international pariah if he perhaps wasn't one already. But I would contend we're trying to get down to the, as you say, the multi-causal and the subtleties of the causes that led him to do that. Now, we have to remember that Britain, France and America had their zones of administration in West Berlin, and West Berlin is deep in the heart of the Soviet zone. Now, I'm going to contend, and it's supported by evidence, that the Americans were meddling in East Berlin with propaganda, with espionage, and as a result of this, Stalin felt threatened, and therefore he lashed out. He lashed out in a in a way you wouldn't.
Yeah.
Carried very little common sense, but it was a response to something as opposed to just some out of the blue decision to try and get the Allies out. He wanted to get the Allies out because they were in.
I will concede that there was propaganda, but it was a two-way process. This was mutual. The East was definitely mingling in the West and trying to disseminate propaganda.
Certainly, but Russia was not in the Western zone. They didn't have an island of communism in the Western zone from which to spread and launch that propaganda and that espionage, whereas the Americans, the British and the French did.
True. That's a quirk of geography, I suppose. But it was a two-way process. As we know, Berlin was the front line of the Cold War, the sort of hub, the womb of espionage, so to speak. So I'll concede that, but it was definitely mutual. It was two-way. And that still remains that Stalin took the first offensive move. And that was, for me, the one event that really catalyzes and accelerates the ferocity of the Cold War, or the pace at which this tragic Cold War conflict is going to actually develop over the forthcoming years.
Can I just say a couple of things? We mentioned military before in terms of Soviet Union leading their military in Eastern Europe. The first side to militarize the Cold War was the Americans, who organized and administered NATO. As a result of NATO, we have what?
The Warsaw Pact.
We have the Warsaw Pact. So the military alliance from the Soviet Union that everybody felt so threatened by was actually a direct cause of the militarization of the Cold War by the Americans.
I hear you, and I'm glad you've brought that up, Dr. Watson. It's fortunate I read my facts and dates. Predating NATO is actually Cominform and Comic-Con. But we could argue if we're going to go down the route of cause and effect, which is exactly right to do. I don't criticise Dr. Watson for doing that. It's exactly what I'd be doing, and it's exactly right and proper for historical analyses. Cominform and Comic-Con predate NATO, as far as I'm aware.
They do, but they were a response to the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. So the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine predate those. Can I just historiographical? Now, these are the general schools of thought on this issue. Immediately after World War II, once the Cold War had solidified, you had the traditionalist views of history, which were essentially the Western views, where the Soviet Union were the bad guys. And then what you had was you had a switch. You had a shift in the late 50s and 60s by the revisionists, led by historian William Appleman Williams, when he published The Tragedy of American Diplomacy, and he blames the Americans. Then after that, you have the post-revisionists, and these guys say, well, actually, it was a bit of a mix of the two. But what I want to draw your attention to is post-1991, once the Soviet archives were opened and scholars were able to jump right in. That gives us a good opportunity to maybe draw some of this to a close, in as much as there was a degree of truth to the evidence that came out of the Soviet archives that perhaps was not there before. And one of the most significant pieces of literature in a book called Inside Kremlin's Cold War, From Stalin to Khrushchev, Russian historians Vladislav Zubok and Konstantin Pleshakov, they have found clear evidence of, and I quote, a genuine desire to avoid confrontation with the USA from Stalin. And this is in the archives, and it's a pattern that is clear to see.
It's been a treasure trove of documents in the Soviet archives, which have really aided and abetted historians in their study and quest to really get to the nub and the crux of this issue. However, I would argue that this stream of historiography that has sought to make equal the balance, was it the demons in the East, the godless communists and the free and righteous West, all that has sought to do is redress that balance, because the pendulum was far too far against the Soviet Union. And I'm going to argue that the historiography of the last 10 to 20 years since the opening of the archives in 1991, all that has done is redress the balance, because it was too far against the Soviet Union and in favour of the West. Now, thankfully, that's become a really rich resource for historians. Now we can see it from the other perspective, but it certainly doesn't exonerate the Soviets from blame. All this has done, historians have sought to, quite rightly, redress the balance and have a more open, candid and lucid debate on that issue. But it hasn't pointed the finger solely at the Americans. It's merely just redressed the balance.
Shall we draw this to a conclusion? So our arguments are thus. My argument is that the Soviet Union's responsibility for causing the Cold War is really based on their defensive actions. That, yes, obviously the situations were exacerbated by the Soviet Union, but that they were merely responding to the United States' offensive belligerence in many cases, but attempts, particularly economically and militarily, to produce a hegemony in the world. And you are arguing,
let's not beat around the bush, the exact opposite. Let's just change, take Dr. Watson's sentences. Where he's put America, I'll put USSR. Where he's put USSR, I'll put America.
Okay.
Therein it lies.
Therein it lies.
Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. That was a really enjoyable debate.
That was a lot of fun. There's the problem with this debate for a 25-minute podcast is that there's just so much material to go through, and unfortunately, of course, because of the time constraints, we have to draw it to a close. But it was a lot of fun.
It certainly was. And you know what? This isn't a debate between me and Dr. Watson. It's a learning aid for you, whoever's listening. Hopefully, to help you get a handle on this issue in particular, but also how to write essays and construct arguments in general. That really is our preeminent focus.
Absolutely. And I think I'm right in saying that our next podcast is going to be on a dissection of King John.
It certainly is. We have a scholar of King John and a speaker of many medieval and ancient languages coming in to bless us with that. So
yes, and we are going to be arguing against him.
Yes,
so that'll be fun.
I'll be on Elliot's side for once. That's going to feel unnatural and synthetic, but it won't last long. Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening to Versus History.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe, visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.